From a secret location somewhere in America, this is your Chill Pack
Hollywood.
Hollywood Hour.
I'm leaving.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
You know, Dean Haglund, we were talking just a week or so ago.
Yes.
About being in Dallas, but also about being in Manchester. Yeah. And then the very next day, a lot of people probably not booking trips to Manchester, as it turns out.
Right, the very next day.
And yet, as I addressed on the Midweek Drive program on Siren FM, and I didn't mean to speak for you, but I said this with, I felt some level of certainty
right.
that we felt the same way. Okay. I am more looking forward to going to Manchester than ever before.
Absolutely. I think so. After that, I mean, it seems tragic, but it's also what a good time to celebrate the city.
Exactly. To celebrate the city, to celebrate art, to celebrate community. And coming together. So we cannot wait. We are in Dallas.
Hooray.
Woo-hoo. And I trust that this will be one of the most interesting podcasts we've ever done from the Marriott lobby in Dallas.
Very few of those podcasts exist.
Yeah.
And I've got to tell you, it's thrilling. Of course, Lily and I drove 1,800 miles to be here. We are staying literally across the street from the Texas Theater. Uh-huh. Where Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested.
Right, where he ran down six flights after shooting somebody to go see a movie.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just saying it happened.
You say so.
Could happen.
To me, it's the place where I'm going to watch episodes 3 and 4 of the Twin Peaks revival on Sunday night.
Oh,
but
wow.
You, how cool to be staying across the street from the Texas Theater where Oswald was arrested and then to come downtown to record with the Lone Gunman. What could be more appropriate?
And here they are, ladies and gentlemen, Tom Braidwood, Bruce Harwood.
So you guys are all here attending the Lone Gunman Con in Dallas.
Yeah, we wish.
Oh, that would be sweet. That would be so sweet.
I don't think there is a Lone Gunman Con.
In somebody's bedroom somewhere.
Also, don't want to know.
Yeah. No, that person is on so many watch lists.
I don't know what you mean.
It's called Famous Monsters.
After
the Famous Monsters magazine.
And you came all the way from Australia to do it.
Well, it was doing other stuff, but they basically paid the ticket.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah, so that was good.
Well, day one of the convention, a little bit slow because I imagine going into Memorial Day weekend, so many people traveling today.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was Memorial Day weekend this weekend.
Yeah, this evening's been slow. I mean, the first part of it, but that's okay.
All right.
I didn't realize being in Australia, this was...
Yeah, this is their big... Yeah.
Right.
And apparently it's the biggest weekend of travel in the United States?
Yes.
Is that true?
It certainly was true at the local Buc-ee's, everybody's Buc-ee's. Most beloved gas station. Apparently it's the one gas station in Texas that's actually the destination. If the signs are...
Really? Apparently the food is delicious. The shopping is great.
Teeming with humanity. All I wanted was a clean bathroom.
Pork
and they
rinds.
Have it in Spain. Yeah.
You have pork rinds?
They have pork rinds. They have everything is beaver approved, too, apparently. And I don't even... Look, fill in your own punchlines. I just read it. I report it back to you.
Right.
I pass
beaver
no
approved.
Judgment.
It's called Buc-ee's?
Buc-ee's.
Yeah. So,
man, we missed that.
Welcome to the oddest opening ever of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Really? I'm not sure if it's ever.
Where do we start, Dean? Where do you want to start? Take it away. I'm going to drink.
Well, let's see. Guys, when was the last time we all saw each other? Did we go over this?
Hartford, Connecticut.
Oh, yes. Hartford, Connecticut, which was
what?
2 years ago?
2 years ago, roughly.
And you were either not allowed to... reveal that the X-Files was
we
back?
Didn't know.
We didn't know yet. Yeah.
We were doing like, the situation was, oh, are we or are we? We don't know. No one's told us. So let's say no so that we're not like, don't turn out to be assholes or something like that.
Right.
And then we got back from the convention and it was like, oh, yes, please come, you know.
Right, and you told me you better call casting because they hadn't found me yet because nobody did a Google search.
It was having that sort of freak out, you know, like, do you know where Dean is?
Wait a minute, Bruce actually emailed me. You emailed me because you were trying to find Dean. Yeah. And
yeah.
I let you know that. They're That's looking right. for you. Hey. And you were all, yeah, okay, I guess. Hey. You know, you. No, this was his response. His response was, I'm all over the internet. Like, they can't find me.
Well, I, you know, I did send an email to Dean, but he never answered. So
yeah, you were on my queue of answering.
It's only been
now,
2 years.
Now we hear the
it's
truth.
It's only been 2 years.
Now we know the truth.
Honestly, 2 years from now, I could have been locked in that Skyway if he had his way.
Why don't you just wait till the early morning and, you know, the Texans would have saved you.
The Texans are good.
Yeah.
Like that. My favorite T-shirt thus far in the trip that I saw, it shows a handgun and a Bible. And it says two things Americans need to be master. Two things Americans need to master. That's a picture of a handgun and a Bible. And then beneath it says, and both are things that are not taught in public schools.
Yeah. Hey, wow. I would totally have gone for a gun for a target practice class. Well, in grade 11 or
and
something.
Of course, if I remember my storytelling, the Bible always stops the bullet. So it's
that's right. So that's why it's on the one side.
Right.
So the narrative of the bullet to the Bible.
It's the advanced class where you put a Bible in your jacket and you stand in front of them.
If we had a Texas audience, it's safe to say they've tuned. They've tuned.
You just lost them now.
So big weekend here in Dallas. Tomorrow at 10:30 a.m. you're doing a panel, right?
Big panel?
No, it's just my apologies, yeah.
And we're going to talk about...
the secrets of the X-Files.
I'm confused because I'm thinking about the end of the panel.
Why? What?
Should be good.
I was thinking the end of the panel is 11:15, so I was thinking that was the crucial time.
That's when you can wake up.
Oh
yeah, okay, yeah. It's over.
Well, seriously, when we go into production on a movie,
short.
I always think about when the wrap party is.
Yeah.
That's the date I have in mind.
Yeah.
That's right. So funny.
And you're doing comedy tomorrow night.
I'm doing comedy tomorrow night, doing one of my... It's actually been a whole year since I've done one of these.
Wow.
Oh, no, half year. I did a Christmas... Australian Christmas corporate show. But that was like outdoor by a barbecue. So it's not quite the same.
Yeah, because it was summer down there.
Yeah, it's summer. Yeah. So Christmas parties are in shorts and barbecues.
So you're doing your stuff, and they're flipping meat.
Yeah,
meat
in front of me. I'm basically beside the barbecue doing comedy, and then they're like have a burger in their mouth, going, "Hi, funny mate." That's right.
Oh my God! Wash it down with a side of Dean Haglund. Wash it down with a side of funny.
Side of funny. Nothing better than choking up a burger into my sinuses, and then.
That's
I'm laughing because I've been there.
Next year it's the same thing, but it's a children's party.
Totally. Yeah, exactly. Kids love it.
Have you been looking forward to this event? And if so, what do you look forward to about these events?
Well, I look forward to it only because I kind of grew up on the Famous Monsters magazine.
Oh,
and,
cool.
And collected them all, bought them all from number one.
Right.
With the horrible, grainy black and white photos and... The really bad editorials.
And didn't it have instructions on some of them, like how to make the monster makeups? Or was that Fangoria?
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
No, it was Famous Monsters that was more about the special effects and how to make monster masks and how to do
like
movies.
They were in love with Dick Smith, right?
Smith. Fangoria was the less respectful version of film Famous Monsters,
right?
I think. It was like Fangoria was like, oh, that's serious. I'm not going to touch that. This is how I remembered in the 70s.
Oh.
Like, Famous Monsters of Filmland will not shock me to my core. But Fangoria,
They try to shock you.
There's nasty stuff.
But they didn't also review, like, indies, like guys who made monster movies in their backyard.
Yeah.
That was Famous Monsters, right?
Yeah.
Fangoria didn't do that as much. They were like, oh, here's what's out in the movie theaters. Here's the big things. But I remember seeing Famous Monsters and, like, here's Doug, and he made this thing about this guy who turns into a lizard. And he did it in his, you know, for $300 using a Super 8 camera.
In his bathtub.
In his bathtub. And look at it. Here's the close-up on how he made the eyes pop out of the lizard's head. And you're like, oh, yeah, okay, I could do that. So what movie has a lizard with eyes popping out?
This is what the internet has taken over from these kind of magazines, you know?
Yeah, it's true, right?
It's like Famous... It was a fan magazine. Nowadays, I don't know what it would be, I guess.
Cosplay?
Everybody would meet somewhere in whatever social media format is most popular.
Yeah, but also the how-to portions of it. Yeah. Like all these how-to videos now.
Yeah, nowadays these things are curated too, so you end up with a sort of hub of activity.
I know, I always think about that scene in The Matrix going, Tank, I need to instructions on how to fly a Huey belly helicopter H21. And then her eyes flicker and go, wait, I could do that now on YouTube. Like, I need to know how to fly a 737 in an emergency crash landing. Yeah. And sure enough, that's how you do it.
So, you're not Saudi, are you?
No. I just like to know this stuff.
Just
good to know. Good to know how to fly a 737. Well, okay. Here's how you do it.
Well, that's cool. I did not realize the significance of the magazine to each of you. This is a popular Canadian thing, apparently.
Well, no, it's not. Is it just Canadian?
No, it wouldn't be in Texas, probably.
Well, when I was growing up, in the town I was growing up in, we only had one bookstore, and it had comic books at the front. And if you wanted more serious comic books, you had to go to the back of the store, and that's where Famous Monsters of Filmland was, alongside comic books that were serious because they were in black and white, not color. That's how you could tell.
Wow.
You know, right. It's like, oh, I'm going to read the black and white stuff because that shit's disturbing. And that's where Famous Monsters of Filmland was. And you kind of have to... I felt guilty. I'm like sneaking it past the guy like, no, I'm old enough to read this, sir. I am, really.
Wow.
You know, because there's monsters in it. It must be bad.
But who was the guy who was doing latex monsters on the X-Files? Remember he... What his name was?
Oh, I got to think about it for a second. The young guy. Yeah.
But he had read Famous Monsters. Yeah. And he was totally, he got inspired by these latex things, and you start practicing. I don't know where the hell you get latex in a store around here, but you melt it down.
You do what the old artist did. You make it yourself at home. Yeah, but up until Dick Smith, well, even including Dick Smith, these guys, they experimented at home, and they brought it to set, and it
worked
that way.
If it was L.A., you know a couple stores on Melrose where you could buy the latex.
Latex that you melt down and make into lats.
A couple stores on Melrose where you can... they'll do that for you for a price. So you're here. Our friend Marina is here.
I saw Hyder. She didn't know you were coming.
Yeah, and you ruined the surprise?
I did.
Oh, my God. Christmas is ruined.
Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, we have a history. All right. What is the connection then? Star Trek to Famous Monsters, X-Files to Famous Monsters. What is the tie-in? Is there a tie-in that they?
There was lots of monsters in the X-Files.
Yeah.
Every third episode was a monster of the week.
Okay.
So there's always that creep out factor. Okay. Gross out.
But
would the magazine ever? Would they do pieces on the X-Files and on the monsters of the X-Files back in the day?
No.
I don't think
they were around. No,
Cine Fantastique did a story.
Yeah.
Okay.
Fangoria did one, I think.
Fangoria must have.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
But I don't remember Famous Monsters ever coming.
No.
But they must have done something about the latex kid.
Yeah, probably. But they never. To my knowledge, they never. I've got a lot of the mags from the X-Files years, you know, like the
expose,
the Rolling Stones with Jillian on the front cover.
Yeah.
It's probably worth a few bucks. I don't know.
No, I think that one got reprinted a lot.
Did it?
Yeah. And for all the shippers, they all love of them in bed like that. Hey, let's not get there.
I got a first edition, but anyway.
Okay. Tom's selling off a lot of rare X-Files stuff for those who are interested.
So
Tom also has 40,000 photos of behind the scenes.
What?
Yeah.
Oh,
and I've been trying to get
that. Not that quite many, but yeah, a lot.
Well, you got a lot. And we've been trying to get it to a book or an Instagram account, anything just to get anybody to see this stuff. And you refuse. I don't know why.
No, I'm not refusing.
I know you know.
You have to organize.
I know. Okay, you say you're not refusing, but every time I say, Tom, you know, just give me like a handful and I'll like organize it. You go, yeah, I'm going to do that.
Whereas I certainly appreciate that these photos, both from fans of the show, but also I'm sure filmmaking, just fans, you know, who enjoy the behind-the-scenes process would love to see these. So I appreciate your point of view, Dean. On the other hand, let me ask you, how is that graphic novel?
Oh, ouch.
So, you know, improv comics in glass houses.
This is a dry lip smack. really dry in Dallas with a dry wind.
And the answer is, it's going great, right?
Yeah, oh yeah. Listen, we are so close.
Novel, we are so close.
Right, except for the rewrite we have to do now.
That's like the health care act in the States.
Why do we have to do a rewrite?
Yeah, you know, this whole thing about truth and the politicization now that... And then we talk about this all this time, right?
We were talking about this earlier, yeah.
We talked about this.
You guys talk. I got to go to the washroom. Go ahead.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah, Tom. Oh, my goodness.
Grandpa, yeah, Tom's still talking. But yeah, I think the graphic novel either becomes a capsule in time, a pre-Trumpian era.
Yeah.
Or I rewrite it for the present day. I'm not sure.
So for anybody who might be joining us mid-conversation about this,
right?
Are we alluding to this responsibility that you're starting to feel?
Well, not just responsibility. There is now the truth has become politicized. So this idea that and we were talking.
Well, has not become politicized, but the idea of but the idea of the truth and the idea of seeking the truth and the idea of representing the truth are politicized. The truth,
right.
It's very difficult. It's very difficult when you invest a great deal of political capital in what you call the truth on either side. Now, speaking from me personally, anything Trump says is, and I could lower my voice because I'm in Texas, is obviously, I say garbage man brings garbage, is basically what I would say about anything that comes out of his mouth. But I granted on the other side... And thinking of some of the more liberal websites I was looking at before the election, the liberal left-wing side of the spectrum does delude itself a great deal about what's going on and what's right and what's wrong.
Well, let me throw this in to the conversation about this, because I've been talking to people about this, and I don't think we've had the chance yet.
No.
But this is an ongoing, evolving conversation we've been having. But, you know, it's this concept that... Perhaps terrifyingly enough, there is a percentage, a base of the supporters for President Trump where it will not matter what he does or how horrible he is because they literally want to say F you to the entire system because they are people who feel... utterly unseen, utterly lied to for so long. So when you say to them, yeah, but you know, Trump is threatening to destroy every institution, they will say, good.
Good. All those institutions.
I don't think they mean that. That's just a way of defending their point of view. And that they'd rather say, yes, destroy it all than say I was wrong.
Oh, that's an interesting concept. Okay, that is an interesting concept. If we can say, though, that at least there are people who have come close to the point that they utterly have lost all faith in their American political institutions, then what role as storytellers do we feel a responsibility for maybe exploiting that distrust of
institutions? Which is the lone gunman, right? Didn't that all represent an F you to the system? Didn't we be the precursors to a fight the man, screw this, the whole system and the Illuminati and all of that sort of thing? But now then that gave birth to...
The idea behind the gunman was that the truth, as in the mainstream truth, was in fact a lie. And we as truth seekers were unveiling what was really true.
Right.
But the idea at the center of it all was that there was some kind of truth.
That made us
heroes.
Right.
You know, yeah. We never really dealt with, in the series, we never really dealt with shades, our own series, we never really dealt with shades of gray.
Right.
Yeah, because we were
a comedy show.
Ambiguous now, right?
Yeah, because we're a comedy show, and you don't want to get caught up in shades of gray in a comedy show.
But I mean,
at least not in the early zeros.
The aliens were gray.
See what you did?
But not shades of gray. Not shades of gray. Just one level of gray.
Because that would have been. We're right back into that alternative lone gunman fiction
now,
that we don't want to talk
that's
about.
That's an episode I want to see.
50 Shades of Alien Gray?
I go into the washroom, right?
Yeah.
Whatever. And I go over to wash my hands, and there's a little glass tray there with this white powdery stuff. And a
I thought that was salt.
It says, indulge yourself.
No, it's salt. Wasn't it salt?
I don't know what it was.
It was like, it wasn't powdery. It was crystally.
Well, yeah. I don't know.
Well, I guess it's crystal meth.
You smoke it.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Indulge yourself with a little pipe.
It was powdery, but it's very humid here.
I agree.
Well,
yeah, Texas.
Well, speaking of anyway. Seeking the truth,
yes,
genuine
yeah.
truth.
Stay at the Marriott.
There is a truth. Yes, this podcast is brought to you by the Marriott.
It's a nice hotel.
And crystal meth.
Crystal meth light. Yes. We're on a diet.
I would point out this, that yes, obviously, I think there ought to be a lot of storytellers looking in the mirror and saying, you know, how are we responsible for what we put out into the world?
Right.
At the same time, nothing about The Lone Gunman or The X-Files before it was about seeking power. It wasn't about feelings of powerlessness inspiring the need to obtain power. It was about feeling that a truth needed to be revealed. And I think a lot of the conversation culturally going on right now where we say the truth is being politicized, it's because it's not about the truth at all. It's about my rampant feelings of powerlessness, and I'm going to do whatever it takes to feel powerful, and how am I going to feel powerful by exerting power over the group that made me feel powerless.
And crushing that and like undermining them.
And so I don't think the conversation is actually about truth or facts or alternative facts at all. I think it's about power and powerlessness. That's what I think it's about.
Yeah, but you say that. At the same time, the conspiracy theorists, and I'm using air quotes, are now not reverberated to tinfoil hats, but to an alt-right
angry guy, Montana thing.
That has Trump as its leader because he too is spouting conspiracy theories on his Twitter. Obama's wiretapping me. He is echoing at the very top of the level something that was underground that has percolated up to the surface now.
Right.
And I personally feel responsibility for that. That's deeply guilt-making, and I don't know what you guys feel.
Well, the thing is, the alt-right aspect to conspiracy theories has always been there.
Yeah, absolutely. But it was never so...
In a lot of ways, it just... Even with the sort of leftist conspiracy theories, right...
Libertarian.
Yeah. Or the... Yeah, whatever. It always sort of tends to go that way.
Go to the right?
Go to the idea of authoritarianism in whichever form you...
Right.
The Bilderberg Group, all that
stuff.
Yeah,
right.
An unnamed or unseen other that we can vilify.
I mean, the thing...
That's always is an element.
Right, yeah.
And there's an element, too. If I was God, here's how I'd fix things. But, you know, if you can't be God, you can always look for a God
to
do it for you.
Well, then let me at least suggest that a major difference is, again, in The X-Files and the Lone Gunman, even if they were wrong... The person who was alone, the person who was isolated, the person who would be subject to pressures and bullying is always the one that would be championed.
True. The underdog.
Opposed to the ones today in public who seem to be claiming a search for the truth seem a lot like the bullies.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
And not like the champion of the little guy.
Right, so how did that transition? When did that transition?
Well, the thing is, again, you have to remember Lone Gunman as fictional characters, there has to be an element of story. And I always believe that a good story takes care of itself in a way. Like Chaplin is always for the little guy, no matter what the little tramp is doing in his movies.
Right.
The Lone Gunmen are always fighting for the little guy. I'm probably going to lose the thread here, but the thing is, that story arc is kind of outside the politics of whatever premise
what saying, right?
We have.
Exactly.
Whoever the little guy is, we are the heroes in that we support the little guy. As politics, it doesn't quite track in the same way.
Right.
Because politics is about gathering your power from whichever source.
It's a power conversation.
So that if you want to make it a power conversation.
Right.
And the thing is, bringing that back, a lot of the people who support Mr. Trump, and I'm just going to expose my prejudices here, is that they are people who believe rightly or wrongly, that they had power, and now they are losing it to kinds of people that they despise.
Right.
Right.
And you can
as we know, they are people who had previously supported the other side and felt betrayed. That happened too.
I don't think there's any Democrats, any real Democrats who voted for
but in the
Bernie.
In the Rust Belt. Not the Bernie, this is what I keep hearing, but you know, in the Rust Belt, the states that swung this were people who were assumed to vote blue, they were never visited once by their
Reagan
candidate.
They were Reagan Democrats from the get-go, those folks.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Reagan Democrats went...
Yeah,
that seems
they went Trump.
So far from away from an ideology.
But it isn't about ideology. This is what I keep trying to get back to, is this is about storytelling. It's not about ideology. That's the point. That's why the Republicans keep alternating between, oh, we can really ride this to power, and, oh my God, we're going to get thrown under the bus that we allowed to be created. Because it's about storytelling. It's not about ideology. I mean...
Well, the guys like the Paul
Trump,
Ryan types
Trump
are the ideologues.
Yeah. They are the ideologues.
But they tell stories in order to pursue their ideology.
And yet Trump, who a few years ago, right, was saying to all his confidants, you know, I should run for president, you know, Republican Party. I'll be the best Democratic president anybody's ever seen.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, their ideology is secondary to the stories that are being told. They really are. And I think it gets back to this idea of, to a large part, feeling that power has been taken from us.
Yeah.
That's the story that we're choosing to believe about our lives. And therefore, when someone says something that resonates, that says the prism through which I view the world emotionally is true and factual, that person who confirms my bias is getting my vote.
Yeah.
And it's not about ideology. It's about making me feel seen and heard, and you telling me I'm right.
Yeah.
Right.
Just as a footnote to this, there was, I can't give you names on this, unfortunately, but there was a documentary from some years back pointing out that many of the current day Republicans were influenced by a particular philosopher who believed that in order to guide the people on the correct path, you had to tell them the great lie. So that part of their ideology is that in order to achieve the right path, you must lie to the people to convince them
to follow the right path.
To follow the right path. In other words, you can't tell them what you're doing or they won't agree to it.
Wow.
And this is a documentary that goes all the way back to the 50s.
Yeah.
Again, I wish I could remember. It's some sort of philosopher who, sort of Ayn Randian philosopher.
Yeah.
Very, very popular with...
And this is like pre-neocon.
These are people like... the people who believe in this particular ideology were supporters of the second Bush administration.
Right.
So this runs right through the mainstream Republican Party
these people seem to be looking themselves in the mirror now.
Because
even
the neoconservative movement,
they're scared of they've attached themselves to a loser. That's all they're scared of.
Well,
and
I think not only a loser, but a loser who, again, getting back to this idea, could actually do significant damage to the infrastructure of power that needs to exist if you're in the power game. If you're in the power game, you need the infrastructure to be there, or there's no game to win. The institutions need to be there, and if significant damage is done...
I would argue that the Republicans are incapable of governing, and they've shown they can't exploit the structure, even the structure of democracy, even if it was there.
Wow.
Tomato, tomato. Yeah. Am I right?
Well, I mean, I go back to, I think, you know, whatever it was, 9 days, 7 days before the election, I think Coney changed America, right, when he came out and talked about Hillary and the emails
and the emails
investigation. I think that completely changed. The image that came to my mind the first time that happened was the scene where the Predator rips out the backbone.
The spine in Predator?
I don't know.
Because it just It just opened a marathon.
Have you been reading about why Comey did this?
A little bit,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, indeed, he wanted to go public about the Russian collusion investigation.
Really?
At the same time. And it was President Obama that argued against that. He had, Comey had an article ready to go with the New Yorker or the New York Times, and the Obama administration said, no, this will seem political. So no word was released of this, and instead, yet the Obama administration was okay with the revelation of the email. It was almost like, you know, when you bend over backwards.
Was this the New York Times, the article? Because they were also saying that Comey was afraid the.
But
he
this
thought,
is
he thought,
what's really critical.
He thought
yeah.
Clinton would win, and then the FBI would be under attack from the Republican majority Congress
because apparently. Politicized, the already heavily politicized field office in New York of the FBI was threatening to go public on their own. And so this is what I've been reading lately. And so Comey had this choice, you know, do we do this? Because if we don't and they go public on their own, well, suddenly what we have is this leaky ship that again America will lose all faith in. And it wasn't that long ago when Robert Mueller was assigned to take over the FBI in the wake of 9/11 because all of America had lost faith in the ability of the FBI.
Right, to so, deal with it.
So it's interesting the pressures that we'll be putting on and who had the influence over the FBI office in New York. Rudy Giuliani.
Okay, most of it is about power games, nothing about the truth.
Nothing about the truth.
Well, that's the thing, because what about, you know, two nights ago, one night ago, the two guys running for governor, the guy beats up a journalist, and the next day he wins.
Right.
I mean, what does that say, right? What does that say about what's going on?
There's a couple different things.
I mean,
in
Bruce
play.
Said it best. He said, "So now it's a license to beat up journalists."
Yeah, right.
You can go ahead and do it, and nobody's going to.
Because you said that journalists are the enemy of the people.
Yeah.
Right. That's
right?
true.
And that's.
I mean,
that's
the guy
true.
Gets charged with assault.
Just,
the night
just so we clear, you guys aren't journalists, right?
Yeah. Right. No. No.
He actually
We're
gets charged with assault.
We,
night
we do characters,
and yet he wins the election. It's really weird, man.
Well, there's also a very interesting thing. There's two things at play about this election. We've talked about it before, but a year ago when Lily and I were doing our annual road trip, we were going through, we eschew the main interstates. We go two-lane blacktop through towns in America that time seemingly has forgotten. And it was in May of last year, end of May, and Lily says to me, Trump's going to win.
Yeah.
And I said, how is this possible? Because we're not seeing any presidential election signs at all. We're seeing local election signs, but nothing. We're seeing nothing. Maybe. And indeed, we're not feeling like we're going into red states or blue states. Everywhere we go, for the most part, people are really kind and generous with their time and their stories. But she said, look at these towns. So many of them feel post-apocalyptic.
Yeah.
They feel forgotten. And when they hear Make America Great Again, it kind of gets back to this idea of something's been taken from us, and we're going to get our relevance back. And Dean and I would talk about this a lot on the show. You know, the danger is, and this is the key to leadership, right? You can speak to people's fear. The question is whether or not you are elevating and seeking to lead them to higher ground. Or if having spoken to their fear, you then confirm their basest instincts. And that's the question of, you know, what a leader will do. But in terms of how these people felt, there was really an opportunity there to be tapped into because a lot of people felt unseen and unheard. The other thing that was fascinating is this new field of study, and I don't know if you've heard about this, but it's the psychology of moral equivalency, where when people have
Trump's
proven
playing that game really well right
when
now.
When people have proven that they aren't something, right?
Yeah.
And in this country, it was, I've proven I'm not racist. After all, I voted for a black president. What throughout history almost always happens is a knee jerk in the other direction.
Yeah.
Right.
So, of course, that president's biggest critic would then take over for him. In Australia, where Dean lives now, they have their first female prime minister, and who immediately succeeds her, but the most misogynistic politician ever who had been just ridiculing her. And the populace was fine with voting for him because, after all, they'd already proved they're not misogynists. Yeah. They voted for the woman.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I was sort of thinking it as you were talking. The one of the reasons that Trump won is because Obama had been president for 8 years. But I think I may put a slightly different emphasis on it, saying along the lines of, like, well, you know, sidebar, Hillary Clinton is not the greatest choice for Democrats, even among Democrats.
Right.
It was kind of like, oh, geez, you couldn't do better than this? You know, she's got such a history.
Well, and you know, you deal with the Comey, and people are talking about, you know...
But pre-Comey, Hillary has a history, man.
Right,
going all
right.
the way back to...
Well, no, that's it. When people talk now about, you know, Trump trying to meddle in the investigations, you know, a lot of his supporters will point, kind of rightly so, and say things like, well, Bill Clinton's getting on a private plane with the Attorney General, you know, and there is a lot of this, is that every quote-unquote leader has to take responsibility for their share and say, you know what, we need to avoid the appearance of impropriety moving forward.
It becomes almost impossible, though, at the standards we're setting at this point. But no, my thought was that, first off, the reaction, the Trump is a reaction to Obama from the people who were like, I cannot believe a black man, and you may fill in the other word they would use, became president. And the shock to the system.
Stylish? Was stylish?
Yeah, stylish was the word.
The black stylish man.
And then the second thing is, for the people who support Obama, were disappointed with his, okay, let's put air quotes around it, failure as a president to transform the universe into something magical and light and beautiful.
Yeah.
After this extraordinary campaign he ran.
Right.
In the midst of one of the great
there is a
economic
feeling to it,
crises.
There is a feeling that, you know, people wanted a visionary, and what they got was mid-level management.
Well,
there is,
like,
a feeling among some people.
Usually,
of
great
them.
Visionaries are usually killed before they can achieve anything.
Well,
so you can always imagine it would have been great if they'd only lived.
And
right?
if we flash back 8 years, you know, and running on a campaign of hope, it was fascinating because there were people who, yes, he was chocolate Jesus to a whole lot of people.
We're here in Dallas, okay?
But it was projection. And then there were a whole lot of people that say he's the Antichrist. It was all projection.
But isn't that what's going on with Trump, pure projection?
Is it? I mean, when you have a leader shoving a foreign leader, literally physically
shoving
him,
by the way.
When you have him saying...
Yeah, my wife Trudy keeps talking about that.
When you have him saying, you know, Germans are bad.
Yeah.
This isn't projection. I mean, these are things... When he admits to sexual assault...
Oh, I know. Yeah.
That's not projection. That's admitting culpability of a criminal act. I mean,
right.
Of saying, I fired the FBI agent to get rid of an investigation. Again, that's not projection. That's...
Yeah.
That's...
Well, I think, speaking as a Canadian, I have to say, what's paralyzing the American politic is the fact that you have this glorious idea of what it is to be an American president. You just can't deal mentally with a guy who's
who's there,
who's clearly seriously mentally ill, and has just like has no impulse control.
But as I said, the mentally ill are seen close to
they've
seen the vote. They've seen God. They're close to the spiritual entity. That has just allowed them to lose their mind, to become mental, so that everything...
That explains Marlon Brando.
Getting back to the idea of projection, we are in the city of Dallas where John F. Kennedy was shot. There's a man, a single president next to Lincoln.
Allegedly shot.
No, he was shot. Allegedly by who?
But there's a character upon whom there is more projected.
Those are your facts.
Yeah, there's a character upon whom more is projected than... almost any president, I mean, I'm including Lincoln.
Sure.
Lincoln actually achieved some things. So let's say, you know, Kennedy is the president that means more than what he actually did to almost anybody.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. That is.
And my point is that he died too young to fuck up, you know.
Interesting. Yeah, because he was already having an affair with a major Hollywood star.
Serious problems with the Cuban thing, you know.
He was doing all that.
Yep.
So, yeah, theoretically... If he had lived past the assassination,
we are in Dallas, and a whole lot of, I think I speak for a whole lot of podcast listeners who say, I didn't want a show on politics.
Too late now.
But a show on showbiz.
But have the two of you ever been to Dallas before?
No.
Nope.
So are you going to go and get in the book depository window just to feel what it's like to hold the...
I'd like to. Apparently the the museum is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
I'd like to see it, yeah.
I've been there twice now, and I think I was there after it newly opened, and I was shocked that, A, you can't stand at the window, that because they got that plexiglassed off with, like, cardboard boxes to show you what it looks like. And then I thought, okay, well, let's see if I can run down six flights of stairs and get to the State Theater in 2.5 minutes to see. And they blocked off the stairwell as well. So you could only take the elevator after going through a metal detector. And then you have to see, like, oh, the Age of Camelot and how great it was.
Is there an interactive game where you try and shoot Kennedy?
Oh, my God. A VR goggle?
Yeah, yeah.
And just see if you can do it semi-automatic,
now in 3D.
Can you squeeze off two shots and actually hit the guy from this distance?
No, they don't have that. Oddly enough, but the darkest thing, and apparently it's not here anymore, but there was a Kennedy tour.
Yes.
In a open air 62 Cadillac.
You told me.
Yeah.
Okay.
I saw it here when I was here in the 90s, and I got to think it was discontinued. But basically, it was a silver Cadillac open air, and then it would drive you through Dealey Plaza at 20 miles an hour.
Okay, that's creepy.
Wasn't that creepy? Man. And it was like this tour group.
And they have a guy standing with an umbrella on the grassy knoll watching as you go by,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Just like waiting for you.
I hate hitting you up with gunmen or X-Files questions that you've probably been asked way too many times before, but I'm going to do it anyway. So I don't hate it that much. So your namesake, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, right? John
Byers.
Fitzgerald Byers.
Yeah.
When you were preparing the role, playing the role, did you do any research into Kennedy?
No. I didn't know I had a Fitzgerald was my middle name until
okay.
Until the episode where it's seven, eight years playing
the character, I was Byers.
Okay.
And then suddenly I got, I've got two extra names.
Okay.
So, you know, it was a big news to me, and that was the pilot of the
right.
Gunman spinoff.
Yeah. Is that when they said it?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's when we all got names, right?
Oh,
we got it when we were arrested. With my names were given to me when it was...
that was the Vegas
Richard
episode.
Belzer. Richard Belzer arresting us.
So there you go, season six.
Yeah,
it was late in the game. It was
I had no chance to plan anything.
Yeah.
Okay.
It gets thrown at you after the fact.
Because it was a beautiful speech about the inspiration derived from Kennedy.
You have more vivid memories of this episode than I do.
I know, I thought it was a really nice piece of writing, and I wondered whether that had tied in with research that you had done in advance.
Research?
But no.
What do you think, I'm method or something?
What kind of actor do you think this guy is?
I told you I hate asking the question. Mostly for the mockery that I'll receive.
I have an old-fashioned version of method. It's the Bela Lugosi method.
Yeah.
Where you look in the mirror and you repeat your name over and over again and go, I am John Byers. I am John Byers. Because like he used to stand and look in the mirror and go, I am Dracula. I am Dracula.
Right.
That's how he got himself psyched up.
Right.
That's the heroin.
Early oath.
Yeah.
No, it was opium. It was much more primitive.
Primitive.
Yeah. My mistake.
Yes.
So you use a lot of opium to prepare for...
Yes.
Is this what I'm hearing?
Just to rest.
Oh,
I was like really tense, you know, so I needed to calm down a little.
Just take
the edge off a little.
But isn't it, I mean, I don't know what one can make of it or if one can make much of it, but I take a certain delight in the idea that there's a convention in the heart of Dallas with characters called the Lone Gunman. I mean, I just think that's, you know, I haven't put that together until now.
That we are actually named
coming.
From the thing. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Nobody's coming.
Nice.
It's still early.
Yeah.
This is just
so
Friday.
So Tom thinks it's still too soon. There's a movie theater, a threeplex, right around the corner from us, or just down the street from us, and I think I've shown Dean the photo, but a few years back when the movie Lincoln came out, right?
Oh, no.
The movie Skyfall was also in theaters. And they're next to each other on the marquee, and I don't know if you remember the iconic image on the Skyfall poster, but it's Bond leaning back, firing his gun right into the back of Lincoln's head. And
those two posters side by side.
And I went to the box office and I said, guys, too soon.
Do you know what's going on here?
And they had no idea.
Yeah.
They had no idea.
Could not laugh at that.
Right.
Or at least switch the photo. Right?
Switch the photo.
Well, not even laugh at it. They didn't understand why that might be. I mean, I just thought. But it's still like somebody asked where we were. We were in Lincoln, New Mexico the other day, right?
Right.
And so somebody said, well, what are you doing? I said, well, earlier this morning I shot Lincoln. And then I went, oh, God, the poor guy can't catch a break. He just can't.
Cannot.
There's no way around the minefield of... anyway, but I do think it is so interesting, the idea that you would be here, that it would be the Lone Gunman, and at this time.
Yeah.
I mean, in our history.
You look at all the characters, actors, and performers that are here, and I go, like, who decided to invite us to this? This is like a little off the wall, right, for us.
Is it?
Well, I don't know. No, it's fine. I don't have a problem
with it. All of the characters here seem off the wall.
Well, I mean,
there's a lot of horror. There's from Predator, and you got Star Trek, Marina Sirtis. And
Sarah Karloff.
Michael Dorn, right?
Sarah Karloff is there.
Oh, yeah, she wrote that.
Sarah Boris Karloff's daughter.
Right. She gave me a book about her dad. Remember I reviewed the book on the show? I was fascinated.
When did you meet her?
Sci-Fi London 1 year.
Lord, did I meet her?
No, you did not.
Oh, good.
You saw the book. But you saw I was never a Boris Karloff fan until meeting his daughter. She gave me this book about her father. And it was... I became fascinated by him. And I can't get enough. Why? Yeah. He's just a really elegant actor.
Yeah. Right? Have you seen The Body Snatcher?
Yes. Watched that not long ago.
It's one of
ago.
The best things he did.
Even these B-picture... I want to call him Mr. Wong. Mr. Yeah. Wong detective, right? Another Anglo actor playing
of Charlie Chan, knocking off Mr. Moto.
Mr. Moto.
Oh,
another
boy.
Anglo actor playing an Asian detective. And it's... if you can get beyond the idea that, okay, white actors shouldn't play Asian characters, it's the only one that's not in any way offensive.
The Mask of Fu Manchu. I mean, talk about offensive, but that's Karloff again.
But he he is Mr. Wong.
No,
you're
original
thinking
one,
fiendish plot. Dr. Fu Manchu.
1932. Oh, my God.
But Karloff as Mr. Wong, his innate dignity... actually makes this character the most noble, and it's refreshing at that time anyway, and it's because of Karloff's innate.
Well, I remember speaking of the Mask of Fu Manchu, which I assume you've seen.
Yes.
Yeah, people asked him when he was still around.
That's okay.
Late in the 70s or early in the 70s, people asked him, "Don't you think that movie's racist?" And he goes, "No." And they said, "Why not?" And he says, "Because it's stupid."
That's great.
That's good.
That really, really is good.
That encapsulates it.
I think it must be fun, though, that something like this happens kind of out of the blue, that there isn't any necessary tie-in to promote something.
Yeah, we don't have to push anything. In the Q&A,
although Dean has written this really nice book about the big things on Broadway.
My art book. I got my art book here.
Yeah.
But also...
Tom's got a book of behind-the-scenes photos from the...
that he's never going to release because he's not releasing the photos, even though he said he's going to. But he's got 40,000 photos of...
Just work on your comic.
Whatever, Tom. Tom, you just keep that in a shoebox.
I love that your graphic novel is just called a comic. I love that. That's like totally... That's out of my playbook.
Work on your comic.
Yeah. Like, play with your dolls. They're action figures. They're dolls.
They're $300 maquettes. Dolls.
Oh, my goodness.
Very collectible. There's only 4 made. Dolls.
The kid that annoyed me outside the post office, swinging a lightsaber around on the day the most recent Star Wars movie came out. When I say kid, I mean somebody in their 20s.
Right.
An aspiring filmmaker.
filmmaker.
But
the kid.
Swinging on the street, just swinging a lightsaber around, acting like he's a samurai or whatever, by himself. Shocking that, by the way. And people are like making a wide berth around him because they're freaked out. Old people are freaked out about entering the post office and everything. So I just took it as an invitation and, went up right behind him. And when he suddenly made a swing and almost hit me, of course, he was really apologetic. And I said, "Hey, no problem. You must be really excited about that new Star Trek movie opening up." And he went, "Well, it's Star Wars." And I said, "Yeah, nobody cares." I know, exactly. But
he's definitely going to become a filmmaker
but
now.
But God, it felt good. Anyway,
so it's good being here.
It's fun being at this. And yet, at the same time, I mean, have people at this point asked about... There's a season 11 coming. The X-Files. Has anybody asked you with this, whether gunmen are getting out of the Black Lodge? Oh, wait a minute. That's another Twin Peaks thing. Never mind.
Oh, that would be so nice.
Look, you know what? Honestly, David Duchovny's... Earmuffs. Earmuffs. David Duchovny's character has been revived in Twin Peaks.
No.
Kidding.
And he's on one of the episodes that airs this weekend.
Oh, terrific.
And best performance he's given in years.
Wow.
And it's fantastic. Yeah. Is he the head of the FBI? Maybe. And still.
Oh, so it's keeping it a long tradition then.
Still transgendered as he was in the old show?
Yeah.
Yes. So anyway, so terrific. He's just absolutely terrific. Maybe the gunman ought to be revived in Twin Peaks.
That'd be good.
I don't think we're weird in the right way to be in a David Lynch movie or TV series. We're the wrong kind of weird. We're in a different universe.
I've just started watching 2.5 episodes of the 1990s Twin Peaks, and to me, it's not weird.
Oh,
it isn't.
Wait till episode 4.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Do you know what
best episode
you will love about the revival, Dean?
Okay.
And that some quote-unquote Twin Peaks fans, the same ones who did not like Fire Walk With Me, which is what's critical to the appreciation of the new revival, this Fire Walk With Me, not the old show. What you would love, as we got back to, is he is eschewing the need for narrative. It is surreal, abstract surrealism.
Great.
With profound emotional resonance and humor. So I watch an entire episode and... do I have ideas of what it means? Of course I do. But really, what I'm doing is I'm laughing harder than I've laughed at anything. I'm being freaked out more than anything else on TV is. For a little bit in the show, in the revival, I've been going, well, this reminds me a little bit of Fargo. This reminds me a little bit of Westworld. This reminds me a little bit of The X-Files. Oh, wait, he's not borrowing from them. He's borrowing back from them.
Right, because he was the precursor.
And he's taking it further. There was a wonderful quote in a review recently, which was the purveyors of peak television right now had better be on warning. They're probably scurrying around right now trying to figure out what to do because the game's been changed by this. At the same time, 35 million people used to watch Twin Peaks in its first season.
Good Lord.
500,000 people are watching the revival.
But that's just broadcast, right? They don't know about streaming or anything.
That's where
the crucial numbers are.
They don't. But
that's where it's going to play out.
But the point is, he's also in a sandbox right now where, unlike those first 2.5 episodes, he sours. When you get to season 2 on the first one, you're going, wow, this kind of went downhill.
But he didn't direct those.
He didn't. He had a big falling out because he thought...
And he was doing Wild at Heart at the time or something like that.
He thought, oh, wait a minute, what do you mean we got to keep stretching this out?
Right.
Right. Ridiculous. Well, it's a success. We want it to go as long as possible. Well, that's not creatively fulfilling.
Right, exactly.
Right.
And X-Files had the same thing. They were going to go to 5.
Yeah.
Remember, it was like 5 seasons.
Yeah.
And then it went crazy, the movie, right?
And then Fox pointed out the contract that said, you are canceled when we tell you you're canceled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so 6 was all right, but then once we got 7 and 8, then it's like, and then David didn't want to do it, and then Robert Patrick comes in.
And, you know, where, like, someone like Vince learned from that, he said, Breaking Bad, it's 5 seasons.
Right.
They got to the end, they said, well, no, we got to do more. He said, no, it's 5 seasons.
Right. I'm killing off this guy.
It starts here, and it ends here. There's going to be lots of things that change in the 5 years.
I like what he did. I don't know if it was 5 years or what, but I do remember, right, the one deal he made with AMC was that he allowed the final season to be split into 2.
Yeah, they made extra episodes and then just cut him down the middle.
The middle. So they gave him a little bit more budget, probably, in exchange. So he played it really smart by knowing what mattered to him in terms of that. What do we think? Is there any chance of seeing the gunman in season 11?
Well, I think there is.
Verbal shrug.
I think there is. I mean, you know.
I'm not asking. Even if you knew. Right.
Well, I can honestly say we don't know.
Oh, my God, if we knew.
If we knew anything.
We'd tell you.
But,
exactly. We'd all have to change our agents. That's right.
Chris is running the new season as before. He locked the lone gunman. So. And the other producers, I don't know who's involved other than him, but...
But, you know, Chris came on Australian television on satellite feed on a morning show, and they had me come in a guest host. Did I tell you this?
Okay, that.
And you
that
put him in a box
something.
Again?
Yeah, yeah. No, I. Well, they had all the questions on the teleprompter. Chris, tell us about the new season. And I said to the producer in my earphone, I go, okay, before we go, I'm not going to follow what you've written. I got a lot of, like, things. And then I'm going to pitch him something. Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, 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 go. Don't read anything off the teleprompter. So, yeah, you know, for Chris, it's like 7 in the morning. And he's got to do satellite feed to Australia. It's like, so he's just like a pre-show. He's staring off camera down to the floor, just like looking like his head's lilting out of camera. Like he couldn't be more bored about this whole thing. And then I go, Chris, this is Studio 10 in Sydney, Australia. We'll be coming to you live in about 45 seconds. And, oh, okay. And we have Dean Haglund here. Oh, hey, Dean. Hey, Chris, how are you, man? Yeah, okay, good. And 4, 3, 2, 1, okay. Hey, we're here with Chris. You know, this is the main host doing that. It's like, oh, man, we got season 11 coming. What can you tell us about all the excitement? Blah, blah, blah. Okay, hey, Chris. So remember Comic-Con? And you said IDW comic book.
We're part of canon.
You said we're official canon.
We played that clip on this show.
Yeah, we played it. And you said specifically that the Lone Gunmen are alive and this is official canon. And we celebrated that in front of like 2,000 fans. He goes, yeah, yeah, I remember that, yeah. Okay, and now you say that we're dead. So what is the parable there? He goes, well, you're alive in the comic book, dead on TV. But I go, but that it's all, how do you tie that together as official? And it's like, and he left it in that vague Schrodinger's cat, you're dead and alive, basically. And then I said, okay, Chris, wait a sec, let me pitch something. Clone gunmen, huh? Bring us back, clones. It's like, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. You're like, yeah, okay.
Oh, man. Jeez, why did you make the clones old and gray?
I know. Like, yeah, exactly. Hey, wait a second. We can clone you as 20-year-olds. Hot 20-year-olds. Oh, shit. Yeah.
Wait a second. Wait a second. I have seen pictures of you at 20. No, they couldn't. Elegant, sultry, but, you know,
hot
20.
No.
I don't know. Answer this however you feel comfortable, but it is interesting, as Dean and I have talked about, both Twin Peaks and the X-Files being revived at the same time. Lynch had a bit of an advantage coming back to this, to my mind, because Twin Peaks initially was, from him, a bit of a cultural criticism at the time of television.
I totally see it.
And he's able to do that again now. And he's there's one whole storyline in the revival about a young man whose job it is to stare at a glass box to see if anything happens. And this goes on and on and on in the revival.
Pretty quickly.
Well, some of these shots are really, really long, though.
Yeah.
Long enough for you to realize, oh, wait, I'm that kid because I'm staring at a glass box right now waiting to see if something happens, right?
Yeah.
So throughout this, there's this critique of television.
Right.
And at the same time, he was fortunate because his lead character is locked into a place from the old show, spoiler alert, Dean, where he is both unchanging and yet aging. And so he gets to come back to that moment with a lead character where he doesn't have to address, what's the lead character been doing? We know because it was whispered in the earliest episodes of the old show, I'll see you again in here in 25 years. And so time has not, quote-unquote, changed for the character, but he's been allowed to age. He's been basically in a waiting room for 25 years. So Lynch had some advantages over, let's say, a show like The X-Files. And Dean and I talked about this a lot, but, you know, The X-Files was so forward-thinking in terms of what TV was going to be, what it could become. And now when you bring it back, are you trying to recapture something? But when that thing you're trying to recapture was something so forward-thinking, how difficult a task is that? And I'm wondering if, in seeing it, Tom, how did you feel that they accomplished this with the revival? Do you think that they focused on recapturing, or do you think they focused on charting maybe a new path for it?
I think the value in the new one was recapturing in the sense of the relationship between Scully and Mulder, which I think was a smart way to go.
Right.
Because of the years, because, you know, and they didn't fool around and try to make it what it was, because it wasn't anymore.
Right.
So I think Chris worked really hard at, regardless of what the basic storyline was about, of making their characters, looking at them in the perspective of where they were now.
Right.
Which is probably what the new show will do as well. And yeah. I thought that was a really smart move on
Yeah,
on
go Chris's to character.
Part. Yeah. And, you know, it says a lot that, I mean, both David and Jillian are really busy people. They still have very professional lives. Mm-hmm. They're doing a lot of work. But they wanted to come back. They wanted to come and do it, right?
They want to work with each other, and they want to revisit these characters.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, a lot of stuff happened in 9 years. You know, when it started in year one, I mean, both of them were so green.
Right.
And, you know, they developed. I mean, Jillian developed into a really fine actress. And David equally so, not quite in the same way, but you know, he learned. He's a really smart guy,
right.
And he figured it out. And mm-hmm. he's had it. They've both had terrific careers.
Right? Yeah.
They've both gone on, and Jillian made some interesting moves going into theater and going to England and
right.
doing all of that, right? And which everyone kind of poo-pooed. But
did they poo-poo that?
A lot of people did, but it turned out she did. She's done really well with it.
I didn't realize that.
Great. Yeah, I mean, her work's been extraordinary.
Yeah.
In addition to acting, everybody knows, working behind the scenes
right.
on The X-Files, I have never heard anybody ask you, aside from The X-Files, because you've assistant directed on so much.
Lots of stuff, yeah.
Aside from The X-Files, what's your favorite job that you ever AD'd?
21 Jump Street.
Really?
And what? See, you didn't know.
I didn't know.
And
that.
Why was that?
It was just a lot of fun. Everybody was really young. I used to be young once.
Wait, what?
Everyone was young. They were.
Did you hang with Johnny Depp?
Oh, I didn't hang with him, but I was good buddies with
Johnny
him.
Johnny Depp hung with Tom.
I handled
Johnny Depp hung with Tom.
I handled Johnny. And you know, they were. I mean, they were in their early 20s. They weren't 16, but
Richard
still,
Greek
they Depp. Were just young and so energetic. And you know, to this day, I don't say this was me or anything, or I'd take any credit for it. But when I started working, I got the job by accident because someone was a real dick doing the job I was doing, and so they called me in, and I was there for like 2.5 years, 3 years until they went to they went from 35mm to 16mm. Anyway, but when I first started working with Johnny, it was the first time.
He's talking about the millimeter gauge of the film, not the amount of dollars.
Yeah. The first time. The first time I worked with Johnny, you know, he would come on set. He had a photographic memory.
Johnny Depp told Tom never to name drop.
Johnny would come.
Johnny told me never to name drop.
Johnny would come in, and he would. We had these sides, these like miniature sides, which were the scenes we were shooting for.
Right, the scripts. The
he
miniature.
Would walk in on set, and he'd say, "Let me see your sides, Tom." And he'd go like this. He'd flip them through the pages in about 30 seconds, and he'd go on stage and do all the. He had this memory.
Right.
Wow.
But the interesting thing about him was, so you would do a rehearsal, right? And that was fine, and everything worked. And when the camera rolled, you could see a light come on in his eyes. Yeah. I could literally see a light.
Wow.
And I thought, you know, this guy is going to, like...
be a big star.
Interesting.
He's going there.
And now he doesn't bother to learn his lines at all.
Well, yeah, it's an unfortunate, you know...
Like,
what does anybody write any lines for him? I can't even tell.
No, apparently there's this lawsuit and the situation with it, whether he or not he beats his wife. Apparently now on the Pirates movie, and maybe he's quite right to do this, but apparently he doesn't learn any lines. He puts an earpiece in his
That's
head.
Marlon Brando.
Yeah, exactly.
With whom he worked.
Exactly, and has an assistant read him his lines, you know, over the radio or something like that.
And you know,
he can't be bothered to waste
well,
time.
Well, you say can't be bothered, but I know there's an acting technique
right.
from the improv world where if you are not burdened down with the self-consciousness of what my line is, oh my God, what my memory, oh my God, where's my brain? Do I know my next line? Oh my God, like all of that shit that goes in your brain.
Right.
If you can remove that, then you are more have a better ability to be in the present and to react directly to the actor across from you.
Well, to that I say, look at Marlon Brando's performance when he had people reading his lines to him, reading them in Superman off cue right. cards, or and in
the cue cards
in the Island of Dr. Moreau. You will see an actor,
but
no, but when he was had the South the South African accent
in Dry White Season, which Dry he White gets Season. An oh, Oscar nomination yeah. for.
But that was an earpiece.
Earpiece
Dry White
they're
Season.
Reading into it. I think it comes down to whether or not he cares. Honestly, yeah, you know, yeah. and at that point, and sometimes it's not. Also, you know, we tell these stories of he doesn't bother to learn his lines. I've you know worked with some beloved actors who have gotten to the age where they lose the ability to be able to remember, and memorization absolutely terrifies them. Yep. But if you let them know, hey, no, look, the lines are going to be here for you. If you look for them, then they can come to them and find them, and it'll be fine.
And to defend Brando, he started behaving like this after he'd done Last Tango in Paris, which was basically one of his rawest performances, where he was basically, I mean, afterwards he was incredibly angry at the director, Bertolucci, because he felt he'd been, his personal life had been exposed on screen.
Post-traumatic stress disorder.
After that, and The Godfather, he was like, I'm done. Right. And this happens with some great actors this happens to, where they just go, like, I've achieved everything I'm going to achieve. I don't need to work anymore.
Right, that's my
I'm
thing.
Finished.
Well, you know, the British actor, Michael...
Michael Caine is a guy who just
No, not Michael Caine, but no. Michael, what's his name?
Michael Gambon?
Who about 2 years ago, probably now, dried up on stage, he just completely went blank. And after that, he left the stage. He said, "Never again." Yeah.
Never again. It was too traumatic.
I won't do that to people.
Yeah,
I will
because
not
Richard
do that.
Harris dried up doing Camelot. He owned Camelot.
He was really, really drunk too. So
I have I have a lot of respect for him for doing that.
Yeah,
he
for
said,
sure.
I won't be doing theater anymore.
Wow.
He's still doing film and stuff.
And you look at Olivier, going back a little further, when he had the situation of drying up on stage when he was playing Shylock in The Merchant of Venice, it was so traumatic that his acting style actually changes after that. You can see it in the films that he does. He goes from being this sort of crystal clear performer to a guy who dithers everywhere. You know,
a way to cover?
And he becomes this massive over-actor and stuff. He lost his confidence.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Well, it'd be terrifying.
Yeah.
Have you gone back to stage? Have you done any stage, Tom?
No, I haven't done any stage in a long time.
Since like 70s?
But I have dried up on stage.
Have you?
That's a terrifying experience.
I dried on stage. I went through a period when I was training at UBC where I dried in every performance I would dry second day, usually the second or third performance of every theater show I did, I would completely dry in one scene. Just like the frickin' Sahara. Just all the water was gone, and I would stand there and I would do this sort of rat-a-tat thing for like 30 seconds where I would run in my head the entire script to the point where I dried and go, oh, that's where I am, and just catch and just scoop back up. And it was like, you know, the audience was like, well, that's an interesting choice, and all the other actors were going, oh man, he totally dried there.
Well, what happened to me was we were doing, when I was at Tammany's Theater, we were doing a show called Fan Chen, which was about the agricultural revolution in China, and I was playing
crowd pleaser.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
Musical.
Hey, in the 70s,
very, very funny, right? And so I was playing a a capo or a cowboy or whatever it was, and I go to this village to talk to the peasants and tell them that they're, you know, they got to work harder and do this and do that. And the way it was set up was that I was up on this platform, and they were all down there looking at me,
right,
with the audience back there, right. And I had this long, like, 3-minute speech, which is a long time,
right.
And I dried up, and nobody could help me because. There's so I'm standing there looking at the audience, completely dried up, and they're all down there looking at me, going, "Oh, he's dried up." And of course, they never paid any attention to the speech because it was like this.
Right, they didn't have to.
Horrible didactic.
Like, we don't have to know that.
So nobody knew where I was and where I screwed up, so there was no one there.
Wow. And that ended the show.
Oh, God.
Good night, everybody. Good night. I left the stage.
Spectacular.
I think I just said, so work harder.
Yeah. Actually, I had an actor once who told me, he said, he dried once on stage, and he said, so I just expressed my motivation. It was a Renaissance play, and he had a 2-page speech to give, and he dried up, and he said, well, my only motivation was to get this guy off stage, so I went, come with me. And they left.
Right.
Right. Get off stage.
Well, that's one of the interesting things sometimes we do in acting class, right, is doing the inner monologue. Instead of the lines, just tell me what's going on. Just run the monologue. I want to know what you're thinking.
Yeah.
I just want to know what you're thinking. And, you know, the really interesting actors, a lot of times what they're thinking has very little to do with what they're saying, like people in real life.
Yeah, exactly.
But you always can, you know, go back to that. Just say what you're thinking.
Say what you're thinking.
Man, say what you're thinking and make the scene be about that.
That's improv.
That's actually a way of getting around drying up, is to realize that it's not about the dialogue as written.
Sure.
Right.
It is about what the beats are. This is the very helpful aspect of this, of the Stanislavski method, is like, if I can't remember the lines, it just means I don't know what I'm doing.
Right, your beats are not.
So it's so simple. Just go like, I don't remember because I don't know what I'm doing. I have to work on what I'm doing.
Right.
It's very easy.
Really. Yeah, yeah.
I always suggest to actors, right, who tend to make it be about, you know, you'll hear this.
By the way, Phil teaches acting in Hollywood.
Right.
Okay.
Occasionally direct. And occasionally direct. But, you know, you'll hear it's so easy to make it be about the words, especially in a business where nobody bothers to read the single space shit in a script. So it's only about the words and we're just going to shoot you from here up. Right, so you don't get to embody anything, but don't make it be about the words, dear God. But you know, I will hear this from actors. You know, they'll feel like, okay, I can't do my best job. I can't do because I don't have it memorized. I'm not completely off book. I'm not, you know, this, that, or the other thing. And you know, I'll suggest to them, you know, who knows the words? Your character. Your character knows the words.
That's right.
So let's worry about finding the character. Yeah. Let's do that, because the worst is, even if the words aren't coming out, what you're doing is interesting because you found the character.
Yeah. Right.
But also the reverse is so often true, right? When someone is word perfect, completely off book, knows everything, and then they drop unexpectedly, emotionally, into something they hadn't been prepared for, and then all the words go away.
All the words go away.
Because they've encountered something
brand new.
And as a director, I love when that happens, because it lets me know, okay, the actors now found something they didn't plan.
Yeah.
Now we're finding something real that's spontaneous, that's being created by what other actors are giving them. That's fine. Let's go back. We'll do it again. But this is what we want to explore.
This is the advantage of film, is that you can stop and start again.
Yeah, I'm introducing into theaters now the director coming in and stopping shows and giving notes and adjustments.
You know, I think that's probably
wouldn't that
done,
be great?
Actually. I think that's been done.
I think that's a Bertolt Brecht thing. Isn't
it? Yeah, exactly.
What about acting from here, Bruce? What aspirations and what would you like to play? What would you like to do?
The stuff I like to play, I'm too old to play now.
What
does that mean?
Yeah. Hamlet. I actually once said, when I was in university, when I was full of arrogance, somebody said, oh, they're thinking of doing Hamlet next year. And I said, oh, I hope they wait a year, because I'm not ready yet.
That's fantastic.
That's awesome.
No, but you're still in the range. You could do a Hamlet.
No, he's like, at the worst, he's 30.
Come on.
No.
Seriously.
Maybe a dinner theater Hamlet? Come on. That'd be an abridged Hamlet?
I can see it now, To be or not to be. Do you want some more water, sir?
Come on.
We'll be back after this break. Sponsor you by Lexus.
I can see it on the marquee. John Fitzgerald Hamlet.
Yeah, that's right.
To beer or not to beer?
Or not to beer. I got two beers for table 7. To beer or not to beer? That's the question. My question is, hey, table 8, who ordered the pasta? Oh, my God.
Alas, poor Yurik. I knew him well, drinks.
Well, great spirits. We have a lot of great spirits, actually. Wine or rye of spirits. They're delicious. Oh, great spirits.
Oh, dear.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
That's hilarious. Tom, any aspirations?
No.
You're done. You're retired.
Are you retired? Are you? Oh, pretty much. See, I like the pretty much.
Well, whatever. I mean, the phone never rings, so if it did, I'd talk to them. But
is the phone connected? Is the phone connected? Have we picked up the phone to make sure it works?
No, the only calls I get is Big Brother's.
Asking you for donations?
Yeah, asking for donations. So.
But you're not dialing anybody going, I want to do King Lear.
No, I'm fine.
You're fine?
I mean, you know, if Chris calls or the agent calls because he wants us for this, it'd be great. I'll go do it for sure.
You're right? Here. After all, you said yes to coming to Dallas.
Yeah.
So you still have a yen for adventure, you know, where that's concerned.
I'm the last guy to admit it, but I like seeing these guys.
So. Yeah.
No. You just made this weird.
All right. Well,
let's you and me shuffle over to the other side.
Exactly.
The nice thing is, after all the years, we still enjoy seeing each other.
Still laugh.
We have a good time together.
It is an amazing thing. Dean and I have talked about this a lot, that far more difficult, you know, so much is made of romantic chemistry in movies and television and on stage between romantic leads, but far more difficult, actually, when you work in the business, to achieve is believable friendship chemistry. That, you know, is so much harder.
Yeah.
You know, to actually believe, these people are lifelong friends. These people enjoy one another's company. They're from often people who have just met.
Right.
And this is, you know, not the only example, but one of the examples of the brilliance of the casting on The X-Files, because the three of you were not friends when you were cast.
No, we had no idea.
And yet the friendship chemistry was there from the very beginning.
That's
true. We're very comfortable with each other.
And then it led to real, genuine friendship.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well, I wouldn't go that far.
Nah. Well, your Christmas card sucked this year, by the way.
There's always the one friend that, you know, is...
the dragon above.
That's dragging them down, but then everybody, you know...
That's right. Three is too many.
That was the name of the episode where you were introduced.
Three
is too many.
The original script, three is too many.
That's right. Long time three is too many.
In parentheses, it's Bruce.
We changed the ending on that one.
All right. Well, I'm glad we've had some laughs after Bruce declared himself persona non grata in these United States of America.
So true.
It's great again here. We've made it great again here, Bruce, and I hope you'll embrace that and enjoy it.
Quit grabbing me.
We're just north of this wall we're building. It's wonderful.
So
it's going to be the greatest wall.
Absolutely.
Anyway, so get out there, see the sights, get into the depository window, feel what it's like to be the lone gunman. And what else do I got?
That's it.
Dean Haglund, have some fun.
Thanks, Phil.
And we'll talk again next week.
Next week. Bye.
Spoiler alert.